What shall we do with the Starbucks bosses? What shall we do with the Starbucks bosses? What shall we do with the Starbucks bosses? Early in the morning. Decorate coffee with a union label. Decorate coffee with a union label. Decorate coffee with a union label. Early in the morning.
Pick it outside till they give us a raise
now. Pick it outside till they give us a raise now. Pick it outside till they give us a raise now. Early in the morning.
Way ho.
And up she rises.
Way ho.
And up she rises.
Way ho.
And up she rises. Starbucks Workers Union.
And that was What Shall We Do with the Starbucks Bosses from the Little Red Songbook of the IWW.
Welcome to the WOB Radio Hour. You are listening to the Tacoma South Sound branch of the IWW, or Industrial Workers of the World. For those of you listening who may not know about the IWW, we are the oldest labor union in the U.S., founded in 1905. We welcome all workers, employed or not, as long as they are not in the hiring, firing class, and we are international, in solidarity with workers worldwide in their struggles for living wages, equity, and respect on the job.
I'm fellow worker Noah. I've been a part of the IWW since March of 21.
Fellow worker Gordon. I use he, him pronouns. I live in Bremerton. I'm a member of the Tacoma branch of the Industrial Workers of the World since 2008.
I'm Lynn, and I'm a fellow worker, member since about 2019. And I really believe in unions. I really believe in the IWW and the struggle for decent conditions for all living people. And workers have to have their rights. I am she, her, and I'm retired.
And I am Marilyn, and I am a she, they. I am a retired mental health worker, on the job for over 25 years with children and families, and I have been a member of the IWW since at least 2007. Here we are.
Alrighty. And giving us a section of the preamble of the Constitution of the IWW, fellow worker Gordon, whenever you're ready.
Okie doke. This is the preamble to the Constitution of the Industrial Workers of the World, founded in 1905. And our Constitution has been amended a bit over the years, but it's been essentially the same. So, rosin on the bow, here we go. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace as long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. These conditions can be changed and the interests of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike be called out is on in any department. Instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized, not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old.
And beginning our show today, we're going to go ahead and start off with some labor news from here in the Pacific Northwest. Starting off with our first story today, coming out of the Donut Workers United down in Portland, Oregon. Those are the workers who organized at one of the locations for Voodoo Donut. There's been a major update for the DWU and bargaining their first contract, and this is according to their official Donut Workers United Facebook page. And I quote, "Hey there, everyone. DWU has been working hard after winning our union election to prepare for our upcoming contract negotiations. We will be meeting with the company this Friday, March 24th, the previous month, to sit at the bargaining table and begin negotiations for a better workplace for all Voodoo Donut employees at Voodoo Donut Old Town location. Since the election, the company has become increasingly strict at Voodoo Donut Old Town and has been forcing many workers out the door by offering us poverty wages, inferior health care, and by overworking our already struggling crew due to seemingly intentional understaffing. Through the turnover rate seems to have drastically increased, DWU is still prepped and ready to bargain for better working conditions for us all that will hopefully give future workers a reason to stay with the company. An underpaid and overworked crew with lousy benefits is a crew that will fall apart time and time again. Though the union encourages the company to focus on employee retention, we are also more than willing to fight for a contract that delivers what workers need to make this job worth keeping for years to come. Please follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for further updates. So that was a union fight down at the Old Town Voodoo Donut location that had been taking course over pretty much the course of the pandemic since mid-2020. They were dealing with a lot of poor working conditions. Like they stated, a very bare-bones healthcare plan for employees. They faced a lot of anti-union actions by their employers, trying to silence the employees or fire people who were suspected of sympathizing or organizing with the union. This is an IWW outfit, I should also mention, and has been one of our major victories over the past couple years. Moving on to another IWW organization here in the Pacific Northwest, the Burgerville Workers Union has just won a James Beard Award, among the most prestigious awards in the food industry, and I quote from their official Facebook page. "We feel encouraged that working class people in our industry fighting for a better world are not written out of our own history of struggle for justice. This award goes to every one of our members, to the single mothers whom the company is threatening to fire for being sick today, to the workers who went on strike multiple times to force the company to listen to workers, to all people who organize to rein in the inequities of corporate dictates. When we started, worker power in our industry was nearly non-existent. Today we are many. At Voodoo Donut, At Fury, Potbelly, Living Room Theaters, New Seasons, and more. May this award go to the many more workers tomorrow who will join in struggle, build a better world for all of us. We are honored to win this award." That's a couple of important IWW-related updates from here in the Pacific Northwest. Fellow worker Marilyn actually attended this next piece of our labor news. This was the March 23rd TAM Workers United Recognition Rally. Yes. Marilyn, would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I would. It was very well attended. There was a lot of energy. People came out from different parts of the community, the labor community, the justice community. There were all kinds of people there representing. Mm-hmm. We had at least three people from our local IWW, and we had our banner, which mm-hmm. was cool. After the rally, well, just before the rally was over, the management of the TAM, the Tacoma Art Museum, came out and said that they would meet around back with the workers, mm-hmm. which they did. And what came out of that is they agreed to meet and listen to the TAM workers, and they gave a date, and unfortunately I don't have that date now, but I will tell you that it's passed. On that date, the workers were exactly where they were supposed to be to meet and talk with the management of the Tacoma Art Museum, and the Tacoma Art Museum managers had been in a meeting before they were supposed to come out. Mm-hmm. They came out and just walked right past all the workers. They did not keep their agreement to talk or listen and left all the TAM workers hanging.
Mm. Fellow, yeah. worker.
Fellow worker, are these folks already organized in a union, or are they trying to form one?
They
are trying to form one at the moment.
Right. They decided to announce that they were unionizing, hoping that management would voluntarily agree to recognize them. Mm. And so far, that is not happening.
This is called a recognition fight, then.
Yeah, that's yes. exactly what it is.
They're trying to basically, for our fellow listeners out there, the reason why getting recognized rather than having an election is really important, because not only is that a faster way to get a union in your workplace with your coworkers, but it helps avoid the bureaucratic breakup of the workforce in standard NLRB union elections, because oftentimes workplaces can get gerrymandered by employers as to who can and can't participate in NLRB elections. So to have voluntary recognition like this means that all of the workers together can have a union recognized by their employers voluntarily, rather than go through a process that could potentially break up their solidarity, or at the very least, break up how they are able to vote in such an election.
So you're actually talking about industrial unionism,
mm-hmm.
which the listener probably knows is opposed to craft unionism, which divides up the labor force and their interests.
Right. Fellow worker Lynn, you had something?
I was just going to offer that the NLRB is the National Labor Relations Board.
Thank you, actually. We do use a lot of acronyms on the show, and it's good to keep a track of what we're using. You're right. The reason why I guess you could call this, I guess it is good to call it, I mean, it wouldn't be an industrial union like how we organize in the IWW, but the reason why they're trying to get voluntary recognition as well is because it's the museum workers themselves, the staff, the custodians, so on and so forth, and the security guards as well, trying to organize under one union.
Why isn't that called industrialism?
Mm-hmm. Well, it would be a form of industrial unionism.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You're completely right on that. So it's interesting to see how that how our philosophy of unionism is kind of beginning to branch out to other craft unions, which we will be talking about in a future episode.
Well, and I've actually been hearing the Pierce County Labor Council starting to talk about the power of unionizing industrially, mm-hmm. which I never thought I would hear.
Yep.
But they've been doing that for a couple years now, so ta-da!
We're slowly bleeding our little philosophy out into...
May I just clarify, what's a craft union?
So, the difference between industrial unionism and craft unionism. Industrial unionism, like the IWW describes, is that everybody under one industry is organized into a union and a specific union branch for that industry. So, if you have people... Let's take the logging industry. That's historically one of the biggest... industries that the IWW has organized. You have the lumberjacks, you have the people that transport the lumber, you have the people that cut the lumber, and you have the people that ship it out from wherever they're cutting that lumber. So you have three or four different departments, for example, within that industry. Industrial unionism says you all work in the same labor industry for this particular employer, so you deserve to get covered by the same union in the same union branch.
Or if you want to look at the issue of education, because you worked in the schools, you wouldn't have separate unions for teachers,
paraeducators,
staff. It would all be one union. Yeah, so what's happened historically in the past is that management has pitted the teachers against the paraeducators or the bus drivers.
That's happening right now in a
That's
lot
right.
of school districts.
And you wouldn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
They'd all be in it together.
I think it was Kent. They were going to reduce by.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So that's the difference between craft and industrial.
Thank you.
So it is good to see that they're taking up more of an industrial union model in this labor fight here in Tacoma. And of course, I have all of our well wishes for the Tacoma Art Museum workers that are trying to organize. And we will keep you updated on any future actions because they're still fighting for voluntary recognition.
Yeah, the beat goes on, folks. Keep your ear to the ground. Listen to what's happening. And we'll try to keep you updated. And for goodness sake, come out in solidarity, because a fight for one worker is a fight for all workers.
Mm-hmm. It especially happens in longer labor fights like this, where there's a lot of rallies or there's a lot of actions that sometimes, you know, it draws on, public interest might wane, but we really need your solidarity and your support out there at these rallies for recognition, because the Tacoma Art Museum managers need to know that the community is rallying behind this union and they could really use our support.
Yeah, I would think that the art museum is susceptible to public relations issues, since they want people to come and see their work and feel good about the museum that we all have paid for.
Mm-hmm.
It just behooves them to have a good name in the town.
Right, right. Moving on towards more international labor news here. As many of you are probably aware, over almost the past month, there have been massive wide-scale strikes taking on in France right now. The reason why these strikes are occurring and have been occurring since, I believe, early March is because the French president, Emmanuel Macron, basically subverted France's version of a Congress to pass a law that would raise the retirement age and specifically the ability to get retirement-related pensions from 62 to 64. So they're essentially increasing the age at which French workers can retire by 2 years undemocratically and unilaterally. There have been many people in their Congress that have protested this, that have spoken out against this, and the trade unions and the workers of France have taken it upon themselves to go on essentially a general strike. French unions have been out for the past couple of weeks. Just yesterday, French workers actually occupied the BlackRock headquarters in Paris, France, and held that building for several hours. We're talking about millions of people, not just in Paris, but all across the country going out on strike.
Fellow worker, please elucidate about BlackRock and who they are just really briefly.
BlackRock is a multinational investment company. They have their fingers in a lot of different industries like energy, housing. They're basically a huge investment company that has a lot of power over a lot of capital. Probably one of the largest corporations on Earth.
Really?
Especially corporations that wield significant political power as well. So it is very symbolic that the French workers would occupy the BlackRock headquarters in Paris as a direct action against a company that is very much involved, not just here in U.S. politics, but in French politics as well. The reason why these strikes are so important is because, and the reason why strikes in France have always been so notable, is because the workers there have a lot more working class solidarity and have historically acted on it a lot harder in the past several decades than I would say American craft unions have. Virtually every union in France right now is out on strike. And as of a recent meeting within this past week, some of the union leaders actually sat down with Emmanuel Macron to try and figure out if there was any way that they could at least protect those retirement protections. But unfortunately, those negotiations fell through and the strikes are continuing. So as for the future of these strikes, there has been a slight decrease in turnout from some of the French unions, as well as especially from the general public, because they've been going on for the past month. But we are definitely looking forward to any kind of resolution to this situation. Obviously, an undemocratic move to increase the retirement age in France would significantly impact the well-being of workers and is a very flat-faced attempt by the businesses that buy out politicians, as always, to essentially milk more capital out of their workers before they can even be eligible for retirement benefits. And this is especially relevant, too, because here in the U.S., the average age of retirement is gone. Typically, we like to think of it as 65, but it's starting to etch up towards 68 and even 70 years of age.
Yeah.
So it would be frightening to think that this country would be willing to replicate what's going on in France.
I hate to break it to you, yeah. Noah, because you're young, but it was 62.
Mm-hmm.
It still is. It still can be. But it is actually 70 for full retirement for even people my age.
Mm-hmm.
I was among the first baby boomers. So, you said, maybe 70, but it's here, 70. And so they're trying to raise it to 72 now, I think.
Yeah, which is interesting because the national average life expectancy is only 78 years.
Right, so what they're hoping is that people die off before they can collect.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
But it speaks a lot to the situation, fellow workers, that in France, they're going to raise it from 62 to 64, and they all went nuts.
Yeah.
Over here in America, well, okay, I guess I could retire at 70.
Yeah.
You know, people just have been so inured to mistreat.
Hey, I retired at 62. I said I could be dead by 70, you know?
But you didn't have a choice. They cut out your department.
Well, no, they didn't cut out my department. They basically eliminated some of the jobs, but I could have worked somewhere else. And I said, oh, no, I don't think so. I'm going back to school. This is for me.
Speaking of national labor politics, though, probably one of the biggest recent labor stories that's taken place is that the Starbucks CEO, correction, former CEO, he got kicked out by his own company. Howard Schultz finally testified in front of Congress after being threatened with a subpoena in regards to unfair labor practices at Starbucks as a result of the current union drive that's taking place.
I loved how
company.
He said it was voluntary.
Oh, yeah. He kind of had to.
Yeah.
Basically, Bernie Sanders was the head of this congressional hearing about what has been going on at Starbucks corporate in regards to their union-busting tactics. There have been, I believe, almost dozens, if not hundreds, of unfair labor practices filed as a result of managers having mandatory one-on-ones with employees, calling the police on workers for marching on the boss, which is something they can legally do, for going out on strike, so on and so forth. There's just been a huge number of unfair labor practices filed against Starbucks, probably in decades that this has ever happened.
And he was pretty arrogant at those hearings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Bernie Sanders is not an easy guy to sit in front of getting peppered with questions.
Here we go.
With God bless him.
That Brooklyn voice of his.
I know.
He's from Vermont, but Vermont, way down south Vermont. But anyway, I wouldn't want to sit in front of him. A clown like Jordan, I could just grin at him and just flip him off. But Bernie got the goat of Schultz. I saw a couple of the excerpts of that.
Mm-hmm.
And Schultz did not respond well in a dignified way. He responded like a
thug.
Like a drunken frat boy thug.
Another big piece of national labor news here in the U.S., Howard Schultz finally testified in front of Congress, in front of Senator Bernie Sanders at a congressional hearing regarding unfair labor practices that his company has been taking on in order to try and bust up the Starbucks workers union. And this is coming out of NBC. Senator Bernie Sanders and former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz squared off on Wednesday. This was on March 29th. In a highly anticipated hearing about the company's labor practices when Schultz defended against criticism, Schultz testified before the State Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, chaired by Senator Bernie Sanders, at a hearing unsubtly titled, No Company is Above the Law, The Need to End Illegal Union Busting at Starbucks. And the hearing, which lasted more than 3 hours, featured a defense of Starbucks labor practices by Schultz, as well as a testimony from Maggie Carter, a Starbucks barista in Knoxville, Tennessee, Jason Saxton, whom the committee labeled a fired Starbucks worker leader from Augusta, Georgia, as well as many other witnesses. The result of this congressional hearing was that, first and foremost, Howard Schultz has been fired by Starbucks for basically failing to bust the union, which is good. The incumbent CEO, whose name I cannot remember off the top of my head, seems to be picking up his slack, unfortunately. He's taken on more soft union busting techniques. He has recently gone on record to say that he wants to go to a different Starbucks location every week and basically volunteer a shift of his time to get to know the employees and to hopefully de-radicalize them from unionizing.
One big family.
Yeah, that's basically their strategy now. But there have been over 200 Starbucks locations that have organized, along with dozens of others that have filed for NLRB elections. And this change of pace in regards to the corporate end of Starbucks is something for us to keep an eye on in terms of what they're going to do in the future to try and bust this union. And this has been going on since late 2020 when the Starbucks Workers Union kicked off. And I believe it was in early 2021 when they won their first union victory. And since then, there's been over 200 locations that have successfully organized with Starbucks Workers United.
I think it would be ideal if those union people did a newsletter and distributed it to all the Starbucks people in the country.
Oh, they did something better, actually. Late last month, they all went out on strike. There were, I believe, more than 100 locations that went out on strike all on the same day in order to basically tell the company to ease off the union busting and to rehire fired workers who have either been suspected in or been directly related to organizing, which is also a huge labor violation.
Well, I'm assuming that the Starbucks owners did not respond as they wished.
Well, I don't think that they had any kind of direct response against the workers. I think what's beginning to happen, and this is just my guess, is that Starbucks corporate realizes that they're on the back foot. Their union busting tactics have been so widely covered, even by the mainstream media, that their PR campaign is not going in their favor. The Starbucks workers union is winning hand over fist. And at this point, they're just trying to keep any further locations from organizing. They've tried the hard busting union techniques, which got them busted by Congress. So they're probably going to switch over to softer tactics now in order to try and maintain their public image. It seems to be that that's the way things are going on the corporate end. And now for a section on the LA teachers and custodians strike down in LA. Would you like to introduce yourself, fellow worker?
Hello, this is fellow worker Irene, pronoun she, her. I've been with the IWW for a little under 2 years now, and I'm excited to be here today. I'll be talking a little bit about the strikes that were happening in late March, so just last month. So I'll start with some background about LA just a little bit. We all know that Los Angeles is massive. They have an economy that would be like the 19th largest in the world. It's larger than some countries. Their economy is larger than the economy of some countries like Saudi Arabia and Sweden. Their school district, the Los Angeles United School District, or LAUSD, has a budget of about $15 billion.
Wow.
And I saw figures as much as $19 billion. Only about 5 to 6% of that budget is spent on payroll. The superintendent, Alberto M. Carvalhos, probably saying his name wrong, I'm very sorry, who led the district side of the negotiations leading up to the strike and during the strike, has a salary of $440,000, almost 10 times that of most of the workers within the district.
I wonder if he's worth 10 times as much.
Literally. So the SEIU overall as a union is made up of K through 12 schools, workers in K through 12 schools, early education centers, homes, and community colleges in Southern California. But Locale 99 is essential workers in K through 12 schools who are like bus drivers, cafeteria workers, teaching aides, ground workers, and special education professionals. Most of these workers bring home a meager $25,000 a year on average.
Wow.
Yes. LA was expensive before inflation, so you can only imagine what, in the last couple of years, what it's looked like for them and how deeply they must be struggling through the pandemic and through corporate price gouging. Many of them were facing financial instability, homelessness, evictions, and struggling to make ends meet. They were also experiencing burnout and a lack of support from the district. They do very crucial work, and they were stepping up during the pandemic to help feed children who were not at schools and provide care for children who could not come to school and otherwise get that care there. Mm-hmm. In December of last year, negotiations with the LAUSD had stalled, and LAUSD and the district leaders had agreed to a confidential mediation process with Locale 99 and to discuss some of their issues and work out their differences, and they chose to go to the media before they, with some of their information and their side of things, before going to, before having those conversations with the union. And that was kind of the straw that broke, from what I've read, seemed like the straw that broke the camel's back. That kind of really drove them to vote for a strike. And there was a lot of unfair negotiating tactics from LAUSD. Locale 99 workers were subject to surveillance and intimidation and harassment throughout the negotiations and the voting process. They voted 96% in favor of the strike, and it began at 4:30 a.m. on Tuesday, March 21st, and continued through Thursday, March 23rd, so it was about 3 days. Their demands were a 30% raise, health care, better hours and compensation for support staff, and addressing the staffing shortages. And during that time while they were striking, thousands of teachers refused to cross the picket line. So all in all, there were tens of thousands of workers, of district support staff, as well as teaching staff in the streets. They shut down the nation's second largest school district. They could, if you look on social media, they can you can see them in picket lines, dancing together, standing in the rain, marching, chanting, "If we don't get it, shut it down." Their signs read things, had things like, "We demand respect on strike." I also thought it was very sweet. And also it makes a lot of sense, but it was very sweet that they had, their signs were in English and in Spanish. The LAUSD did try to block the strike, claiming it was unlawful since the workers hadn't exhausted all bargaining avenues. But that is a tactic by big companies, by district leaders, whoever, to like frustrate people and wear them down and keep them talking and talking in circles so that no action and no progress can be made. So... yeah, so we should really be proud of Locale 99 for taking a stand and not allowing the exploitation of their workers to continue, for bringing a reckoning with reality about these people's lives and that they can't afford to live them. Also, altogether, shortly after the 3-day strike, they received what they were demanding, a 30% pay raise, retroactive pay of $4,000 to $8,000, depending on job classification and years in service. $1,000 bonus for those who worked from 2020 to 2021, average salary increases from $25K to $33K.
Yeah.
7 hours of guaranteed work for special education assistants.
All right.
Yeah. And fully paid health care benefits for many of the staff.
Sounds glorious.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
It's especially impressive that the teachers wouldn't cross the staff picket lines.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I
Big
think that's
deal.
Great solidarity.
Yeah.
Well, and the teachers need, just among other professions, the teachers need those supports.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, ideally a teacher would have a para, each teacher. I was a para educator.
Oh.
And for sure, teachers need that, people to, you know, anyway.
Hmm. Yeah, and Max Arias is the executive director of Locale 99, and he wrote that in the future they want to work in some other things into their contracts, better training and more hours for staff, decrease in the number of unassigned days on the academic calendar.
Right.
So days where the school is closed for like holidays and they're not getting paid. You can only imagine what that does to someone who's already living paycheck to paycheck, to have 2 to 3 days of pay just not there. I think we should be very proud of them. And just like generally when I see things like this, it makes me think of the vested interest elites, companies, what have you, have in taking away the power of the strike, like that court case that's moving, that's under review by the Supreme Court right now,
mm-hmm.
where workers would essentially be liable for the losses and damages the company incurs.
I remember talking
strike.
About that in previous
the
episodes.
Potential yeah. losses.
Yeah. And this shows why, because it's so effective. It got them, they went out there and they fought, they were in the rain, they called for support, and they got what they wanted. It's just, it really is our like most powerful tool, so we can see why they want to ruin that and make it so even if you do win your strike, well, now you and your coworkers are going to be facing lawsuits that you can't even, that you won't even be able, you won't be able to fight or cover, and it won't even be worth going on it. So that's just something I was thinking of as I see how Locale 99 shined and how they stood up for their community. Really proud of them for fighting against a sort of class warfare. They just wanted them to stop hoarding that money.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, when we see this strike, we also see how even when those teachers and, you know, bus drivers and cafeteria workers and everybody was on strike and they weren't working, they were still working in a way for the district. They were fighting for the district. They wanted the money that they knew was there to go to what it was meant to go to,
mm-hmm.
which is supporting staff, making sure that they have... that they can put food on the table,
mm-hmm.
and that they have a place to stay. How can you teach and do whatever and do your work if you don't know where your next meal is coming from, or
exactly.
you have an eviction
right.
notice on the door?
Yeah, so it's not just the kids that are hungry.
Yeah,
it really goes to show that the workers really do know what the best welfare possible is for workers on, you know, in the rank and file on the ground, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
That they really do have that direct experience of what it's like not just to be a teacher but to work within the district, and that they know that
mm-hmm.
that funding being given to teachers and staff would ultimately increase the quality of the education being provided to the students.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for reporting.
Thank
that.
You,
great
Danny.
Report.
Yeah.
That was good.
Good
thank
job.
You.
Yes.
Yeah. I know that was probably one of the biggest teacher strikes that we've had in this country in the past couple of years as well. It makes me think back to...
We had Tennessee, though.
We had Tennessee as well.
Mm-hmm.
There was also the Tacoma teacher strike. Gosh, it must have... feels like it was a decade ago.
I was part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember actually visiting my teachers on the picket line. It was the first strike I had ever been to when I was younger. And, it, you know, just not only here in Tacoma, but also all the way out in L.A. and Tennessee, it really goes to show that the fight for better conditions in education for teachers and staff is still continuing, and that there is those resources and that funding available for the workers so that they can get what they need in order to better educate their students. Thanks again so much for that report.
Oh, yeah. And I just want to end it with one of Locale 99's rallying cries.
Oh, let's hear it.
Cuando luchamos, ganamos. When we fight, we win.
All right. When we fight, we win. Thank you so much, fellow worker Danny. That pretty much closes out our labor news section. We covered just about everything there. As always, we will continue to provide updates on current and future organizing activity from some of these stories, such as the French workers, the TAM workers continuing to organize here in Tacoma, any future teacher strikes, hopefully. As well as the continued Starbucks Workers United, Starbucks Workers Union campaign. Moving on to our roundtable discussion, this is Earth Month, and Earth Day is coming up soon.
Yep.
And we figured we want to take a little bit of time off to talk about unionism and the environment and how workers organizing can help better protect the environment. Fellow worker Marilyn, would you like to kick off on this? Because I know you
Well, I had some specific things that I wanted to talk about. I have explained in other programs what environmental unionism is and how that differs from environmental racism, for instance, and how the different battles definitely overlap, and really it's a united struggle. So environmental unionism started because our planet is in trouble, and not only is our planet in trouble, but the people who are working in the industries such as logging or oil or other extractive industries, often their well-being is sacrificed also. So the places where they work, if they live anywhere around them, are so polluted that their health and their family's health suffers, or there aren't sufficient safeguards on the job to protect them. And then, of course, environmental racism also covers in that area, because the areas that are the lowest income, urban areas, tend to be the places where we put our most polluting, extractive industries, because, hey, land is cheaper there. And so then people who live in those areas, who may not be able to leave because they can't afford to leave, because the value of their home has gone down because of the very same pollution, so they're stuck with it, and their family suffers. Places like Cancer Valley. And then we know now, of course, we've known for 25, 30, 40 years that our planet is heating up to the point where mass migrations are going to have to happen in order for people to continue to live. And then we have these artificial boundaries that we call country borders, that we don't want one person to come across our, quote, artificial border, because we have it better than they do. So there's all of that wrapped up into one. And of course, this is Mother Earth Month, and the day set aside is April 22nd. So there are lots of events that will be happening, but I wanted to talk more about specific things and little points of good news, if I could do that.
Go ahead.
So I want to start with the state of Washington, and this is in Rail Labor News, dated March 28, 2023. Judge rules Burlington Northern Santa Fe Rail oil trains violated tribal agreement. So the federal ruling says railroads unilaterally exceeded limits in pursuit of profits. So this is a legal victory. This is from Anacortes, Washington. They violated the terms of an easement agreement with the Swinomish Indian tribal community by running a 100-car train of crude oil across Swinomish the Swinomish Reservation in Anacortes for years. And a federal judge ruled Monday that this was in violation. Just a minute. So U.S. District Court Judge Robert Lasnik said in a written order Monday that BNSF unilaterally decided to increase the number of trains and cars crossing the reservation without the tribe's consent between December 2012 and May 2021, quote, in pursuit of profits. A 1991 agreement allowed trains traveling in each direction to carry no more than 25 cars per day, not per trip, and required the railroad to tell the tribe about the nature and identity of all cargo, and they didn't do that. So a second phase of the trial is coming up, and it will consider the tribe's claim for damages. The tribe learned a nearby refinery would begin receiving crude oil trains through county planning document. And this is going to be really interesting to watch what happens here. Fellow worker Gordon.
I was just going to note that Anacortes has a huge oil refinery. And several years ago, it had a horrendous accident and some workers were killed up there. And it's just a new wrinkle in the situation that the Squamish tribe had to bring suit for, you know, that's a federal violation. Mm-hmm. I like that. And shout out and gratitude to the Squamish tribe.
Yeah. So that's one piece of rail news. Another interesting piece of rail news, the U.S. Department of Justice sues Norfolk Southern Railroad over the Ohio train derailment.
Mm-hmm.
So lawsuit is seeking damages for alleged Clean Water Act violations following crash of train carrying hazardous materials. So it's very interesting. The U.S. Department of Justice, on behalf of the Environmental Protection Agency, is suing Southern Norfolk, Norfolk Southern, over the derailment in East Palestine on February 3rd. And this is going to be interesting. Now, a bunch of elected officials went out to go door to door and talk to people about this, and they all got sick. As they, so that's part of this too, is that they are recognizing that this vinyl chloride.
Okay. They went to go scope the area out.
Yeah.
And they all came down with rashes and respiratory problems.
So it says, meanwhile, it emerged that a team of government officials became sick while investigating the health effects of the toxic train derailment when they had visited the Ohio site earlier this month. So much for the train saying, the company saying, oh, there's nothing to see here.
Yeah.
Well, that's just hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought those were very interesting things that I wanted to share. Let's open it up for discussion. Here we are on Earth Month. It's April. We have plenty that's horrible that we can talk about.
Well, I think something that I wanted to touch on really quickly, there's something that people have talked about over the past several years as the environmental crisis has gotten worse.
Well, duh, yeah.
Called, quote-unquote, green capitalism. There is this mainstream push to essentially divert our attention away from the socioeconomic arrangement of the economy and of society. And
you mean capitalism?
Yes. better way to put it. There has been more and more outspoken criticism of quote-unquote greenwashing and green capitalism in many major industries today. Greenwashing and green capitalism, to our fellow listeners, basically the whole concept behind that is if we can just make these industries more environmentally regulated and protected, then we can help protect or possibly undo the damage that those industries cause. For example, you hear about this with liquefied natural gas being a cleaner fuel to use for shipping or for energy production rather than, say, coal.
But it's not.
No, but it's not. So that is one example of greenwashing by major energy industries to say, well, we have this cleaner fuel that we're switching over to.
Yeah, it doesn't put out as much CO2, but what about the methane?
Right, and also we're still putting CO2 into the atmosphere regardless. Yeah. We should be moving towards more green energy.
And methane is 82 times more of a factor in climate chaos.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think how green unionism interacts with this is that green unionism, at least as we've talked about it within the IWW and as we try to educate other fellow workers about, is that green unionism says, no, actually capitalism is like the root cause of this problem. It is the pursuit of profit that causes environmental degradation in the first place. And by organizing our workplaces and organizing industrially, we have the collective power to stop that. So as Earth Day comes up, I imagine some of you are already seeing some of the yearly cringeworthy commercials put out by some of these major industries talking about how much they're doing on a local level to, you know, try and support environmental protections or how they're updating their company to try and be more protective.
And if you haven't, just listen to some of PSE's advertisements. Mm-hmm. They're puke-worthy.
Yeah. You're going to be hearing a lot of that corporate rhetoric over the next few weeks. And we just want to remind our fellow listeners that a lot of the people that are making these ads are kind of the people causing the problem in the first place. And it's good to be cognizant about that as we talk about future environmental protections.
But let's also talk about as we make the switch over from oil and gas and things like that to windmills and solar, we need to take a look at, yes, we want to retrain the workers and we don't want them to lose jobs.
Yes.
But they're at real risk of entering into new labor professions that don't have union protection.
Yes.
Because specifically written, because these are seen as essential switchovers, they have written out union protections. And we have to do everything we can to make sure that these workers that are being retrained have all the same protections.
Right.
Otherwise, their jobs will not be worth the switch.
I completely agree. I think a lot of the, and that also especially hits a note for me too, because a lot of times when we talk about trying to put in further environmental protections, and like you say, trying to end some a lot of these industries and transition them over towards green energy, the conversation about how these organized workers are going to be protected and if they're going to have a union in their future employment is hardly ever discussed, even by mainstream environmentalists. And I think that it's very important, especially from the perspective of green unionism, that we don't want to screw over these workers. Workers who work in coal, such as the United Mine Workers, petroleum extraction and refinement, transportation.
And it bleeds over into environmental racism if we don't. Or certainly bigotry, whether it's white women or people of color, whatever. They need the protections.
Absolutely. So, yeah, part of green unionism, and especially as the IWW has discussed green unionism, is that we want to make sure that these unions set into place a transition plan so that when these industries do eventually end, fingers crossed, those workers can go either into another energy-related field where they can keep their same union or even just the same union protections that they had from their previous employment in their new employment. And that's really important because if the general welfare of the working class ultimately suffers, it's going to be either because of the degradation of the environment, and like you said, environmental racism being tied into that, or it's going to be because they don't have the union protections in the first place for things like wages, hours, benefits, so on and so forth.
So I think it's worthwhile for the listener, if you happen to be a voter, our Congress critters happen to be Democrat, to write and let them know that in their eagerness to switch over to a green economy, that they definitely also make a point of protecting workers with worker rights and unionism.
Yes.
I think it's important that we talk to our fellow workers in other labor unions.
Oh, yeah.
There are a couple of labor unions who will vote against the elimination of, for instance, I don't want to make a call out, but the laborers union works on pipelines, and that's how the workers put food on the table.
That's right.
And so they're going to be ostensibly, they're going to say, well, no, I'm not going to vote to eliminate this pipeline because that's my job, it's my paycheck.
Right.
So we have to reach out. We have to show that, first of all, there ain't no jobs on a dead planet.
And second of all, we're not just walking and turning our backs on them.
That's it. Precisely.
I actually like that, too. I mean, don't get me wrong. Talking to legislature,
That's one thing.
Is very important for putting on public pressure for environmental protections and for hopefully more protections for unions as well.
But of course, reaching out to those unions. Of course. You're absolutely right, Gordon.
That's the education part of organize, educate, and emancipate, the three stars of the IWW. The education part is being able to say, hey, fellow worker, sister or brother, you know, we understand that you need to put food on the table. We're not trying to take your job away. But we also don't want to kill the whole planet.
Right. And we want to fight for you
exactly.
So that we can make sure that whatever job you have next, you still have a union and you still have those protections. You're definitely right. And you especially hit a note for me as well, because I know that there are some, as we leftists would probably say, reactionary elements within some of these labor unions that work in energy production or extraction or transportation. People who might vote more conservative because maybe it will lessen their tax burden or because it will protect the employment that they have in the short term. And it is important that we do that outreach and we talk about how ultimately in the long run, you're going to lose your job because the environment's going to get destroyed and you're going to be dead. Or at the very least, this industry will eventually end and we want to make sure that you still have a future, whether that's in green energy production or in some other work environment where you have a union.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that I especially look forward to. In terms of expanding environmental unionism, I think that in order to better protect the Earth, first and foremost, workers need to get organized in the first place. We need to make sure that workers can have a strong union in their workplace so that they can then put into place as part of their... I know that the IWW isn't a huge unemployment contracts, but if they form a contract with their employer, that some of those stipulations be environmental protections, especially for workers who work in workplaces that are specifically high polluters, mining, energy extraction, so on and so forth. You know, the fight begins with organization itself. And I think that that is something that we in the IWW especially like to emphasize.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole lot more. If the listener wants to go to Labor News from RWU, and there's little hyphens between labor hyphen news hyphen from hyphen RWU, that's Railroad Workers United.
Mm-hmm. I think in terms of another form of action that I think workers can take in order to help expand environmental unionism and environmental protections in the workplace is obviously direct action. We've talked previously about how there have been more and more environmental activists who have been taking on direct action in terms of how they've been protesting. For example, there was tens of thousands of people who went to a mine in Germany and basically blocked...
It's a lignite mine, and lignite is probably the almost as dirty as the tar sands as far as being an efficient energy source.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it had been closed, and they were just going to reopen it for strict, you know, profit-making ability. And the whole town pretty much turned out and said, no, get rid of this poisonous stuff.
Right.
You know, so it's very heartening.
Yeah. So as more and more activists take on more direct action against polluters, I think that that kind of action might also be important for people
mm-hmm.
who might be wanting environmental protections in the job with or without a union, hopefully with a union. They need to also be sure to pressure their labor unions as well, especially if they work in energy extracting industries in order to take on more environmental protections.
Right, and right here locally, we can stand in solidarity with local indigenous people who are trying to at least slow down that whole liquid natural gas
mm-hmm.
thing. You stand with the Puyallup people because they're being directly affected again.
Mm-hmm.
And we can fight the giant houses from coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And we can fight the idea of these little municipal airports that they want to pave over and put in over...
There's another
farmland.
Airport that they're planning to put in down towards Yelm as well.
That's
a lot
the one.
Of the local
That's
residents
the one.
Are pissed. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's lots of things we can do. And on April 22nd, for those of us in the Tacoma area, there's the 15th annual South Sound Sustainability Expo,
mm-hmm.
which people could learn about.
I'm going to be there with KTQA, one of our fellow broadcasters. 95.3 KTQA is going to have a booth at the Sustainability
Expo.
So
you don't know. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Anyhow, it is from 10 to 3, and it's at the University of Washington campus at 1900 Commerce Street.
Mm-hmm.
So come on down. There will be all kinds of things. You will learn a lot. You will go away with your head full and hopefully your heart joyful.
Absolutely.
About positive things you can do.
Mm-hmm. I think that's about the conclusion of our roundtable here.
Well, I do want to encourage people to go on Steve Ongard's Environmental Green Unionism site, which you can find on Facebook. So go ahead and look for Environmental Green Unionism, and you will see plenty of thoughtful articles that you can read up.
What was that name?
Pardon?
What was that name that you mentioned?
I mentioned Steve Ongarth, O-N-G-A-R-T-H.
Correction there, it's Ongarth, G-E-R-T-H.
Ongarth?
Yeah.
O-N-G-E-R.
Correcto.
Okay. Yes. Stand corrected. Thank you, Gordon. Anyhow, check it out. It's a very thoughtful website. You'll learn a lot, and you'll also get directed to lots more. They've been doing a chapter-by-chapter analysis of Judy Berry.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, Judy Berry was one of our...
IWW organizer who also worked with environmental groups down in Northern California.
At Earth First.
Yes, at Earth First. Mm-hmm. And managed to somehow align the industrial workers of the world, which were famous for timber beasts, loggers, people out in the woods, and the Earth Firsters, who are pictured as, you know, radical eco-freaks, but they managed to get them together to, you know, negotiate with the companies for mutual goals.
That's right.
She got the loggers and the wobblies together, which was pretty good, pretty unique. And then she eventually died from an assassination attempt.
No, she died of cancer.
Yeah, but I believe the effects of that.
Oh, they probably did, but the actual cause of death was cancer.
Right. Yeah, but she passed away too early. She did some pioneering work. She was a strong IWW. And Steve Ongert's outfit down in the Bay Area is actually an IWW caucus. It's the Environmental Caucus.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So it is a recognized group within the IWW.
Yeah. And it's very informative.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're going to go out, hopefully, whether it's to the Sustainability Expo on the 22nd or to any Earth Day event, just remember that there are plenty of workers in these industries who do this energy extraction and do energy transportation and things like that who still deserve protections, and that part of the conversation definitely needs to take place in order for better environmental protections for those workers to happen in the future.
And on a purely environmental note, if you happen to be in a place where you have some grass growing around you, coming up is No Mow May. So here's the reason why you can feel righteous about being lazy. If you leave the grass in May, you are saving lots of ground-dwelling bees. Did you know that there's over 75 types of ground-dwelling bees in the state of Washington? I had no idea. But when you mow, you destroy their homes right when they're setting up their nests. So No Mow May and save the bees, because they help pollinate everything.
So what are you supposed to do if your grass keeps growing?
You know, put up a little sign for the neighbors and say, this is not an accident. I am not lazy.
Be happy.
I am saving the bees. Be happy. Yeah.
Wildlife preserve.
Yeah.
You know, just down the hill from my parents' house, right along the street, there's this huge section of gravel that has this almost light dirt and dust intermixed into it right next to the surface. And there's a whole bunch of ground-dwelling bees that actually live there. And so my parents and I have, when I was still living with them years ago, kind of collectively decided that, like, yeah, we're going to renovate the other greenery on their property, but we're going to leave this section by the road alone, just because, I mean,
there are
hundreds of little teeny tiny holes you would never notice. I mean, if you stepped on it, it would just crush inward.
Right.
But yeah, no, there's definitely certain environments that you can set up in your lawn, as well as No Mow May, in order to allow that grass to grow and allow those bees to make shelter and reproduce and keep their populations up, because they are a very important group of pollinators in the insect family. Yeah.
So for those of you that come by my house and think it looks like hell because I haven't done anything in my yard, hey, I'm waiting for No Mow May.
There you go. And it's a good reason not to do yard work.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again for joining us for a roundtable about green unionism and the Earth. We hope that whatever you do for Earth Day or Earth Month and in service of the environment, thank you so much for joining us. Coming up here next, fellow worker Gordon is going to be giving us some notes from the Kitsap Peninsula and the recent IWW activity out there, their nascent branch, whenever you're ready.
Okay. Greetings, fellow workers and listeners. I'm here to tell you about some events in that wonderful land across the Narrows Bridge, Bremerton and Kitsap County and environs. And as you may have heard, last couple of episodes, we're getting busy out there trying to form a chartered branch of the IWW Not that I don't love my brothers and sisters and fellow workers here in Tacoma or Seattle, but we're going to be starting our own thing hopefully pretty soon, and we'll be in touch. But to get things kicked off, on May Day, we're having our first, well, we've already had a film night, but we had it in a library. This time, we're going to have a film night on May Day at the Charleston Theater on Callow Avenue, 333 North Callow Avenue in Bremerton. It's easy to find, and there's parking around the theater. Well, it used to be a shipyard worker family movie house. And what it is now, for the past 10 years or so, it's a punk venue. And they got an all-ages bar, which is pretty cool by me. And they have loud punk music. If that's not your taste, then you better bring your earplugs.
Bring your earplugs and
bring some money to buy drinks, and you'll have a good time. But anyway, the film is going to start off with a couple of fellow workers singing Bread and Roses, because the film is Ken Loach's Bread and Roses. And it's a good movie, and it talks about the struggle in L.A., I believe it was, with the Justice for Janitors outfit. They had, I think that was part of the L.A. school district, too. So they had Justice for Janitors, and this is a fictionalized version of that struggle, and it's a really good film. We all previewed it. And so that's going to be happening May Day. The doors are going to open at 6:30. The movie's going to start at 7, or at least the show's going to start at 7. We're going to show the movie. We might have a brief discussion. There's going to be other outfits beside the IWW. We'll have pamphlets and magazines for distribution. If you want to contribute at the door, we appreciate all donations, but no fellow worker will be turned away for lack of funds. Mm-hmm. If you can stick a buck in the can, we appreciate it, and you can have a good time.
There was a previous punk concert there at the Chuck a couple months ago, wasn't there?
Oh, they're frequent.
November. Mm-hmm. Well, the one that WW.
Yeah, we showed up to that one, and it was a benefit for Food Not Bombs.
November.
Yeah. Well, this time we're going to be up on the marquee. Woohoo! So that's a good thing. Come on out.
Yeah, it is.
Check out the Bremerton, soon-to-be Bremerton Kitsap IWW.
How much longer do you think it's going to be before you can formally incorporate?
We are aiming for by the end of the summer.
Yay.
We want to get chartered.
That's wonderful news.
And we've got all kinds of stuff in the works. We've got, there are ideas, but we have some very practical-minded people in our outfit. And one of the ideas we're kicking around is the Kitsap Permanent Real Estate Collective. Right? And what this means is exactly what it sounds like. We aim to buy some land and put up some shelter for people who need it, and some of us are planning to live there also. So it'll be a collectively run land cooperative.
Now, the last time I talked to you, there was no way that people like us could donate to it.
Well, because we're not established, we don't have a bank account even yet.
Okay.
So it's like, we will be set up, hopefully, for, well, after this benefit show, we might have a can full of millions and millions of quarters. You never know. So, we're going to...
Okay.
We just have to get our act together legally. But we got two lawyers in the outfit, so that's pretty good.
Yeah. Nice.
So anyway, they're going to open up the kitchen, and they're going to open up the bar, and it's an all-ages thing. It means it's family-friendly. As long as you don't bring little Timmy up to the bar, everything will be cool. And we'll have outfits with literature down near the mosh pit. So, yeah, go ahead.
Speaking of May Day, I know that that's going to be coming up, and unfortunately, by the time our next episode is broadcasting, it will be past May Day.
Well, this is the one.
Yes, it is. May Day, to the listeners who are unaware, is the International Workers' Day. It was started in the early 1900s, and it was the original May Day. It was the original celebration of working class people and their contributions to society. It was internationally recognized, and it still is internationally recognized.
Everybody else in the world celebrates Labor Day on May 1st.
Except the U.S.
That's right.
And the reason why we have Labor Day later in the summer, here in America, is because the early iterations of May Day, and as it continues to exist around the world, is that it does very much focus on the working class struggle of people who are, say, trying to organize a union in their workplace, or ultimately to fight against capitalism as a whole. That was really the origination of a lot of the labor movement. And
but the capitalists couldn't have that, could they?
No, they can't. May 1st in this country is actually still recognized as a law day or law and order day
by the
federal government. Because
what is that code for?
Anti-working class is what that's code for. So the reason why we in the IWW especially stress the importance of May Day is because it still has that radicalism of focusing on the working class struggle.
Internationally.
Internationally as well. Across borders, across trades. We want to fight for a better world for workers. And so, you know, when we talk about these upcoming events for May Day, the real Workers' Day, as we like to call it, we do also encourage you to read up on the history of May Day as well and how that holiday has been traditionally celebrated.
Can start with the Haymarket. The Haymarket Riot. That's a good thing to research.
Right.
I got one more.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. So after our May Day thing, that's specifically an IWW thing. But we also have another outfit out there. A lot of those people joined, took out red cards. And they have a long-standing record of putting on these punk concerts, and they bring people from all over the western part of the state. And so on the 9th of June, 6-9, this year, 23, Sabotage Noise Productions. Gee, I wonder where they got that name. Anyway, Sabotage Noise Productions is going to present a concert with Baptation, the Neuromaniacs, Raw Dogs, here's my favorite, Molotov Juice Box. And this is a benefit for the Puget Sound Prisoners Association. And we're reaching out to them, and we're going to look to try to form an IWOC out there pretty soon.
Oh, we'll help.
But I know. You guys better help. I'm going to drag all you out there to help us out.
Well, which one is David Rovics going to play at?
He's going to... When the hell is he coming? I forgot right now. But he's been hired.
I want to definitely be out there for
that. Okay, well, I'll send you that more detailed info. Okay.
We can also post that on the WOB Radio Facebook page as well.
We could, thank you. I keep forgetting about that.
You got anything else?
Yeah, the outfits that are going to be distributing magazines and pamphlets is the good old IWW, and then Emergent Goods, Detritus Books, Crime Think is going to be out there, Fugitive Distro, Historical Seditions, that's my favorite name. And we're getting our logo on the marquee. We're not a logo, but just a shout out to IWW. And so remember, 333 Calo Avenue, and even if you don't want to attend an IWW event, you can attend a pretty good punk concert. So come on into town.
You're so enthusiastic. I get really jazzed.
Well, it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
I lost my hearing in the shipyard a long time ago. I don't mind.
The music, is at just the right volume?
Yeah, I can barely hear that.
No earplugs required.
Are we at the point where we can do announcements?
Yes, absolutely.
Good, because I've got a couple. So following up on Gordon's announcements, I want to let the people know that Whole Washington for Universal Healthcare, Single Payer Healthcare, has been working for several years on a documentary. And as we've been working on it, it's attracted the attention of some very amazing people. The newest version of this that's coming out is narrated by Susan Sarandon. And it is its world premiere in Tacoma at the Grand Theater on May 19th at 7:30. So that's for Whole Washington or Universal Single Payer Healthcare. Come down, it's free. I know it says you have to sign up for tickets. You probably need to do that because of spacing, because they're being careful about COVID, but it's not that you have to pay money, although they will gladly accept a donation. What they would really like is they'd like your energy to gather signatures to try to get this again on the ballot. Go ahead.
Could you please give a brief description of Whole Washington and the Single Payer Initiative here in Washington State?
I can, briefly. Mm-hmm. My entry into it was through Red Berets for Washington, which was my friend Laura Fielding's brainchild. She is an avid crocheter and knitter and crafter. And she decided, after serving in the military in Germany, where she was absolutely ashamed of the fact that they, in Germany, had single-payer health care. They had free health care for everybody. And people were asking her questions like, why don't you have it in the United States? And knowing as a veteran that she had it, but the rest of the United States didn't, really got to her. So she started putting out energy to create this in the United States. And what she did is she made these red berets and she gave them to people that were willing to work on the issue. And she started getting red berets that were made by people all over the United States. Men were crocheting red berets in Illinois and sending them to her to redistribute. Well, pretty soon she came to the attention of a nurses union that was working on universal single-payer health care. And they were calling themselves Whole Washington. So Whole Washington and the Red Berets got together. And it's been a national movement for a number of years now. And we are heading that way. So this is the story of why we need, through personal people, through people's personal journeys and stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be at the Grand on May 19th. Many of us have been collecting signatures for years now, but of course what happens is every year we have to start a new initiative. So this is this year's initiative, and we will get there.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting campaign that's going on right now, because we've always talked about single-payer healthcare being something that will hopefully be a national institution so that people can better afford
it. But it happens province by province in Canada. That's how it happened. I believe Labrador may have been the first province that voted for single-payer universal health care, and it went from province to province to province till all of Canada. Go ahead.
I believe it was Alberta.
Maybe.
Yeah. They started out in Western Canada.
Oh.
And because they, like the Midwest of the United States, they had a lot of socialist-influenced people in Western Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So they started in Alberta.
Okay.
And I think that's a good strategy for single-payer health care as well, because with initiatives like Whole Washington, it means that individual states can instead set up their own single-payer system, and then hopefully that will have more traction as more and more states gain momentum in that field.
How many signatures are required? Because if you got to start every year...
It's always based on the number of people who voted in the last election.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird.
Yeah. So the more people who vote, the more signatures you have to get.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Which, you know, I will never discourage people from voting.
Oh, no. But it just seems like a very burdensome process.
It is.
That being said, I think that a lot of people will be in favor of it, especially in this state and around these parts.
Post-COVID, you mean?
Absolutely. Yes, fellow Worker Lynn?
Was it not Massachusetts where Mitt Romney was the governor?
Mitt Romney was the governor of Utah.
No, he's a senator there now.
Oh.
But he was a governor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And anyway, he created health care for all in his state. And that was partly what Obamacare was, was based on.
Yeah.
And then it didn't spread here.
Yeah. And of course, what happened with Obamacare is that it gave it, there was enough leeway for private insurance companies to eventually reverse or to act against some of the protections that single-payer system had. Yeah. So I think doing it on a local level, or in this case, a state level by state level, is definitely going to be a more successful campaign to wage, I think, in terms of single-payer
health. So the other thing I wanted to bring up is those of you listening to WOB Radio know that you're also listening to Radio Tacoma, KTAH, which you can find at 101.9 FM, or a low-powered station. Well, Radio Tacoma is looking for a home.
Mm-hmm.
And we have discovered that, unfortunately, we have to play a little bit of the capitalist game.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, if we want to rent, if we want to buy, we have to show that we have an income. So Radio Tacoma is calling out to all of our supporters of all programs, if you want to keep hearing local news instead of iHeartRadio, if you want to amplify Tacoma's voice and things that you're interested in, Radio Tacoma needs 100 donors to donate $15 a month. Mm-hmm. What that would do is that would show a mortgage company or landlord that we have the income to be able to rent or buy a space. So that's what we're looking to do. Mm-hmm. And you can go to our website at radiotacoma.org and hit the donate button. We're looking for regular donations. If you can't do $15 a month, we'll never turn you away. But we're trying to show, rather than a one-month dump of money, regular income. Mm-hmm. Because that's what these capitalists are looking for. And I don't think we've ever really asked for money before, but now is the time.
Not that I can remember.
Yeah. And so we are working in conjunction with KTQA on this. Yes.
Is the KTAH a tax-deductible organization?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so yeah. that's a good impetus.
Yeah, we're a 501c3, but I like to call us a C3PO.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
So this is what a lot of radio stations have gone and done. There's of course, we know about our NPR outlets, there are several of them, but even the highly successful KING-FM, which was a commercial station for decades, started by the Bullet Sisters, they wanted to keep classical music in Seattle and in the region, and what they did is open themselves up to being a listener-supported radio station. And they get bundles of money because they get a lot of rich people who like classical music, but they also get, you know, little squeakers like me, $10 a month.
Yeah.
But it's tax deductible, and as fellow worker Marilyn was saying, if they can show a steady income stream, you know, that's what seals the deal for being able to rent or buy a place.
Right. So you can go to radiotacoma.org and you can hit the donate button. You can go on Facebook and it'll guide you in the direction. And please support your KTAH 101.9 low-powered FM radio station because it supports WAB Radio.
You said that also 95.3 KTQA is also helping out with this in some way?
Yes, but this is a shout out for KTAH.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just finishing off our announcements here today, I also have some other May Day related events that are coming up. There's going to be a May Day celebration at Heritage Park down in Olympia. That's being hosted by the Thurston Lewis Mason Central Labor Council.
That's always really fun.
Mm-hmm. The ones down... The May Day celebrations in Olympia are always fun. There's a nice little mm-hmm. community of radicals down there that really
but
do...
But I'm going to be in Bremerton.
Yes, absolutely. So if you live down in the Olympia area, or if you know somebody who lives in the Olympia area, this is a May Day celebration at Heritage Park. It's on Monday, May the 1st, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., and again, that's being hosted by the Thurston Lewis Mason Central Labor Council, the TLMCLC. There's also another May Day event actually happening relatively near Kitsap. This is all the way out in Aberdeen on May 1st. The Black Flower Collective is going to be hosting a May Day on the Harbor in Aberdeen, Washington. There will be further details posted on the Black Flower Collective Facebook page. In terms of time and specific location, they're advertising live music, raffle prizes, labor history, and more. And as I said earlier, we will be posting more details on our WAB Radio Facebook page as they come out. So those are some local activities coming up for May Day to celebrate the Real Workers' Day, as we like to call it in the IWW. We'd also like to encourage anybody who's looking for some... If anybody's looking to do some local volunteering, Home in Tacoma, the Tenants' Rights Initiative, is still hosting canvassing events through the Tacoma branch of the Democratic Socialists of America. If you reach out to the Tacoma Democratic Socialists of America Facebook page, you can get involved in that. That's another local initiative here in Tacoma.
There's plenty to do there.
Yes, there is. And what they are campaigning for is to get an initiative on the ballot that would basically protect tenants in the city of Tacoma with a tenants' bill of rights. This has occurred in other cities in other countries as well.
They need 8,000 signatures by mid-May.
Yes, they do. So if you're looking for a volunteer opportunity to protect tenants and renters in this city, to make sure that they don't get unfairly evicted, that they have time to adjust their finances in case their rent increases, so on and so forth. Please reach out to the Tacoma Democratic Socialists and get involved. They could really use their help, and if this initiative gets on the ballot, it would mean a lot to working class people in our community.
It means the working class people wouldn't be priced out of being able to live where they work.
Absolutely, yes. So if you would like to get involved, please reach out to them. I think that's pretty much the end of our upcoming events and announcements. We want to thank you again for tuning in to WAB Radio. If you would like to hear our program in the future, you can feel free to listen in to KTAH 101.9 Radio Tacoma, KTQA 95.3 LPFM, also out of Tacoma, and our new station all the way up in Bellingham, KZAX 94.9 LPFM up in Bellingham. That's our newest broadcaster all the way up north. We really appreciate their support, and hopefully the Bellingham branch of the Whatcom Skagit branch of the Industrial Workers of the World will also be contributing to our radio show in the future. So please stay tuned.
Wouldn't it be nice if one day we were everywhere?
I know. Please, if you know of any low power FMs, whether you're out in Kitsap County, whether you're any further north in Washington State, or if you're listening to us online at radiotacoma.org, we keep a backlog of all of our previous episodes there as well if you'd like to listen in to previous topics we've talked about. If you know of any radio station you'd like to hear WAB Radio from, please reach out to us. We'd love to make those connections, and we'd love to have union-powered, worker-powered radio on in your city.
And in the meantime, don't mourn. Organize!
Absolutely. Solidarity to all of our fellow listeners and unionists out there, and we hope you join us next month for WAB Radio. Solidarity.
Solidarity forever.
Solidarity.